Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. In this episode, we're going to try to get through all of the B's in the networking section. So that's, well, we've already done Blues and Blues firmware and a couple of others, but we're going to start with BootP, and I think we can get well into the C's. So here we go. First one is BootP. BootP is a little bit like DHCP, which is, of course, the mechanism or the system that assigns IP addresses to hosts on a network. BootP can do the same thing. The difference, one of the differences is that BootP is mandated. It's manual. It's something that you know all of the hosts that could possibly connect to your network, and those hosts identified by their MAC address, by the hardware address burned into the hardware, you give those hosts an IP address according to the MAC address. That's it. Those are the only computers that can get an IP address on your network. Now, I mean, that's not a security measure, understand? That's how it works. BootP is a static assignment. If a host boots onto your network and spoofs its MAC address, then your BootP daemon will assign that host an address. Because BootP and DHCP are both sort of, well, they both look at the same, they both use the same port. You cannot have them both running on the same network. I mean, you can, but things would break. DHCP, of course, assigns hosts IP addresses dynamically. You sign on today and you'll get one address. You sign on the next day, you might get the same address. All best effort is made to give you the same address. But if addresses have been recycled and have sort of been used up, then a new address is assigned to you if someone else has the address that you were using the other day. And there's a lot of sort of flexibility with that system. BootP, manual assignment, but the other part of BootP, the other feature of BootP, and in fact the meaning of its name, it is BootP refers to bootstrap protocol. So it is designed to detect a computer when a computer starts, when it's powered on. That computer sends its MAC address over its network, from its network card. So it identifies itself, and BootP recognizes it, and then it can not only give it an IP address, but it can also assign an image, a boot image, to that host. And it becomes an option on that host. I mean, if you're pressing the right interrupt keys and so on, it becomes an option on that host to boot on an operating system delivered to it over the network. It's a pretty impressive technology. You may have experienced this if you've ever used a thin client. They don't typically use BootP. BootP, I would say, is a little bit old-fashioned. I don't think it's been declared deprecated, but I mean, it is not quite as flexible as a bunch of other tools. Pixieboot is pretty darn common. It's kind of hard to find a device these days without Pixieboot burned into its firmware. So I think you're going to come across Pixieboot, that's PXE boot, pre-boot execution environment or something like that. So Pixieboot is common, and it kind of does the same thing. It plays in the same space. It actually, by default, I think, uses DHCP to do the IP address assignment, and then it uses some other thing to deliver the operating system over the network. BootP, though, can do basically the same thing. Both of these, essentially, if you want to think of them in any way, I would probably think of them as sort of a bootloader over a network-based bootloader. So if you think of Lilo or Grub for your desktop or your laptop, it's kind of the same thing, except it's happening over the network. BootP
let's do most on var log packages BootP.
Most importantly,
You'd think it would be most importantly, but the file is actually pretty sparse. In /etc/, there's a file called bootptab, and that is the bootp table or the configuration file for bootp. The sample delivered along with bootp in this package, not very useful. So you're probably not going to learn, unlike, I think it was last week we were talking about big and confusing bind. And there was this great example file, right? You don't get that with bootp. That's not what you're getting here. Bootp is, it is a bunch of, it's 50 lines of comments and not useful comments. Not terribly useful comments, or at least I should say there's no config file there that you can just start and have it running. Like that configuration file is not a workable configuration file. There is a good example of it though in the man page, so we'll look at that in a moment. Other than that, there's the bootpd, the daemon itself that's in user s bin, and then there's a couple of other like bootpef, don't even know what that is, bootpgw, and then bootptest, which I guess tests bootp, I would imagine. But what's really kind of, I think, what you kind of have to look at first is man bootptab. And this kind of gives you all the keys that you need, really, for bootp to work. And I mean, like, keys as in key value pairs. So the boot file is a custom format of configuration. I don't find it terribly difficult to, no, terribly easy to sort of look at and kind of understand until you kind of get a feel for what kind of information it's trying to convey. I don't love it when configuration files are written this way. I don't find it intuitive, but I mean, you can pick up on it. So the man page, there is a sample bootptab file that is, you know, mostly workable. I mean, it's not copy pastable. Oh, you've got bootp running now, because it uses a domain name that you would not be using in real life, and MAC addresses that obviously, you know, your network devices would not share those MAC addresses. So it's, you know, there is a lot of changing that you would have to do, but if you want the format, this is where it is, man bootptab. And the first clause of the configuration file is kind of let's call it a function, I guess. It's .default:, and then a bunch of key value pairs. So one of them, for instance, is HD, and it points to /user/boot. Well, if you go back up to the top of the man page and look through the keys, here's HD boot file home directory. So that's talking about where bootp is where all of the things that you need for bootp to work, where is that located? In this case, they've got it in /user/boot. And then there's DS equals net server, Lancaster. Okay, well, what's DS? Well, that's the domain name server address list. So in this case, they're using something called net server and Lancaster. Your network probably doesn't have either of those two hosts on it, so you'd have to come up with your own DNS list. What's next? NS. Well, that you might start to pick up on what we're doing here. NS, of course, stands for name server, and they list two name servers that, again, your network wouldn't have. TS, probably a time server. SM, probably the net mask. What would that stand for, though? Host subnet mask. Yeah, okay. Yeah. SM is subnet mask, so that probably actually is 255.255.255.0, but maybe not. It kind of depends on your network, obviously. GW, what does that mean? GW equals gw.cs.cmu.edu. Well, you're probably not actually at Carnegie Mellon University, so this would be a gateway server. So that might be, well, you know, whatever your, it might be your router, it might be your home server that serves as a gateway server. It might be the gateway server of your organization, who knows, and so on. So you would go through the list of configuration options, customize it to your own setup, and in theory, that's kind of that's the default settings for what you expect, or, you know, your network settings. After that, you have to then define the hosts that you expect to join your network, and define them by their MAC address, and define which configuration template you want it to use. Now, you only have one configuration template, which is .default, so that's what you would set everything to. But if you had a different configuration that used maybe a different gateway server or a different name server or a different whatever, then you would have a .my settings, and you would have defined that with a different set of keys or a different set of values for the same keys, and you could point some hosts to that and some hosts to your .default or whatever. They call it table continuation, TC, table continuation, which in parentheses they acknowledge is basically a template. So, I mean, there are other options. I mean, that's just a little sample of a basic setup, and it is there in the man page. So if you want to try setting this up, that's where you could start. As I say, I don't know how common BootP really is these days. I do kind of feel like Pixie Boot is probably the more common thing that you're going to see running on most networks. And that's in part because of the ability to use DHCP with Pixie Boot, whereas BootP replaces DHCP. And for every host, you have to find out its MAC address, and you have to list it in your BootP tab file. If it's not there, it doesn't get an IP address. So for some controlled environments, like a test lab or a classroom, something like that, then maybe that makes sense. But for, I mean, and even then, it would be a classroom that was very tightly controlled. I think, honestly, if I was running a classroom where I wanted all the students to be able to boot off of a networked OS image, so that we would all be on the same, you know, everything, I could be sure that everything was exactly the same across all computers, I still wouldn't use BootP. I would use Pixie Boot with DHCP, and that way, regardless of whether I had to do a quick swap out of a computer at the last minute because one suddenly is not working as expected, then I wouldn't have to go back into Boot P tab and modify all the settings. So Pixie Boot and DHCP, really, I think they're the modern alternative to BootP. Why BootP is included in Slackware, I'm not really sure. Probably because it is an option. I mean, it is there. It does exist. I don't feel like on levels of support, I don't know how much I think BootP really is kind of quote-unquote supported. I mean, it's obviously supported. It's in the package list. It's installed. But, I mean, if you look at that configuration file, there's no sample there because there's a sample in the man page, and there is no start file. So usually in Slackware, to start a service, like a daemon, you'd look in /etc/rc.d/rc.something. In this case, I would imagine it would be rc.bootp. That's what I would expect to find. And you could chmod that to be executable, and then you could start that service with /etc/rc.d/rc.bootp/start, or all of that, except instead of start, you could stop it with stop. But there is no such file here. Patrick Volkerding didn't bother putting a service file, which, I mean, I think is fine. He's got plenty of example service files, so it would be trivial to create your own. I'm just noting that it's not there. So I imagine BootP is largely here just kind of because BootP exists and it is an option, but I would not be surprised if it's more for legacy support, I would imagine. I've never asked, but that's what I'm imagining. All right, next up is BridgeUtils. BridgeUtils is declared by its man page as deprecated. So, well, actually, BridgeUtils is a package, and it has no man page. Let's really quick look at what's in BridgeUtils. Okay, so in SBin, there's a command called brctl. You can say that bridge control, you can say bridge cuddle, you can say bridge CTL, you can say brctl, whatever. However you want to say it, bridge cuddle is in SBin, so that ships with BridgeUtils. And then there's a header file and a library in lib64 for me, and a man page for bridgecuddle. And in the man page of bridgecuddle, way down at the bottom, it says, obsolete notes. Bridgecuddle is obsolete. I don't really understand what that means. I don't know what the word, I mean, I know what the word obsolete means, but I don't understand what it means in this context, because bridgecuddle still works. So it's obviously not like obsolete in the sense of it no longer functions. It clearly functions. So maybe what that really means is that it's not maintained. I'm not sure. But it says instead use bridge command from ipRoute2 package for a more full set of features. So there you go. I don't know. I'm used to bridgecuddle. That's the only, I might have used ipRoute2 before, but I mean, kind of, not really. I mean, I'm sure I have. I'm sure I've used it. But bridgecuddle I ended up using quite a bit. Although I don't, I think it was for a container. Early on containers, I think when you started a container, if you wanted it to have internet access, you needed to set up a bridge. And I think that's probably how I kind of got started with bridgecuddle. Back then it wasn't considered obsolete. It was considered probably, you know, exciting and new. So bridgecuddle, if you just type in, I mean, it is in SBIN, so you do need access to SBIN, which you might have to type in sudo bridgecuddle, or you might, if you haven't set your environment for sudo or your paths for sudo, then you might have to do sudo /sbin/bridgecuddle, brcuddle, whatever we're saying. Either way, once you gain access to that command and type it in with no other arguments, then it spits out all of the sort of subcommands available to you, and they're rather intuitive. I mean, bridgecuddle add bridge, or addbr add bridge, and then the bridge, a bridge name, guess what that does? It adds a bridge, with the name of whatever you've given it. Del bridge, that deletes a bridge. Add if, add an interface to the bridge. I'm just reading this off the screen. This isn't even me explaining. This is like literally what it says. So it's quite well documented. Del if, that deletes the interface from the bridge. And then a bunch of other stuff that I don't even know what they do. They set a bunch of things to set, like set hello time, set aging time. I don't know what any of that is. Show, that shows a list of bridges. Show max, that shows a list of MAC addresses. Show STP info. And then STP on or off. I think that must default to on. I don't see where it says. It doesn't seem to say whether it's a default on or off. But I imagine it would have to be a default to on. STP is spanning tree protocol, which essentially is the thing that avoids a bridge becoming a bridge to itself. You know, sort of like creating these endless loops of like, oh, I've got a message, send it to the bridge. Which brings us to like, what exactly is a bridge? So if you think of a, I don't really think of it as a bridge so much as more of a signal splitter, or maybe you could call it a signal repeater. You could also just think of it as like a hub, although not a literal network hub, which is a thing. This wouldn't be that. But if you think of like a switching station or something like that, that's kind of what this is. So what is a bridge? So a bridge is a virtual component that you can add into your network and send data to the bridge. And then that bridge can send that same data to a bunch of different interfaces. Like I say, kind of a signal repeater in a way. And the advantage here is, for instance, if you have a virtual machine running on your desktop or a container for that matter, although like I say, well, I guess in both of these cases, a lot of times all of this happens for you these days. Like this is a lot of the tools that you probably are using, they're just running bridgecuddle or something like it in the background for you. You'll never know. In fact, if you run bridgecuddle show right now, if you've got virtual machine like Vert Manager or something like that, or what's the other one, VirtualBox installed, quite possibly, actually, I don't know about VirtualBox. They might use their own special thing. I don't know. But if you're using like the KVM virtual machine tools on Linux and you're running Vert Manager, for instance, to sort of manage them in a GUI, if you do a bridgecuddle show, you probably have a virtual bridge 0 device, even if you didn't ever set it up consciously. Mine's called VIRBR0, which I always think looks like Verbro. But virtual bridge 0, bridge ID 8000.5254, blah. STP enabled, yes. That's why I think it must be on by default. And then interfaces is empty right now. But if I were to start a virtual machine, maybe, and there's a little bit of a caveat here, because a lot of these don't use the thing. They don't use the bridge. Let me look at the settings of the network device of this. Yeah, so by default, I guess, in the virtual manager software of that I have installed for the KVM QEMU virtual machines, by default, it looks to me like they use a virtual network by default that just uses NAT. So in other words, it just hands all of its network traffic over to your actual computer, your host, and asks you to forward it on on its behalf. And all the traffic looks like it's coming from one place, sent from one more or less central gateway. And that's your host is essentially, the gateway server for this virtual machine. But you don't have to do it that way. You could set your virtual machine to a bridge device. And then at least in my interface, there's a device name place, so I could type that in. So that's just VIRBR0. And then I'll hit apply and go back over to my terminal, do bridge cuddle show again, and still no interfaces. That's because the virtual machine is not running. let's run this machine. This is a Slackware machine that I use for testing Slack builds mostly, and sometimes for experimenting with things for this show, actually, when I'm researching stuff. Okay, it's booted, or it's at the, there it is. VNet 0 is now an interface on my virtual bridge. What does that mean? Well, it means when I go to the internet on my virtual machine, I'm sending that data to my bridge interface on the host, and then it's being sent through, over my Ethernet connection. Is that any different than doing a NAT? Not really. I mean, not ultimately, but there is a slight difference. And that is, if I sign in, hold on, I have to look at the keyboard because the virtual machine isn't using Dvorak. That's the dangers of learning Dvorak keyboard. You forget the QWERTY one, or at least I did. Okay, so if I go into this virtual machine and open a terminal, and do, probably sudo IP. I don't know where the IP command is. Probably in, what would it be? Just slash bin IP? Or is it, I don't know. Nah, probably sbin. Yep, there we go. Okay, so it tells me that my IP address in this virtual environment is 192.168.122.82. And if I look at my bridge on my host, on the actual host running this virtual machine, VIRBR0 is 192.168.122.1. So from my virtual machine, I should be able to, for instance, SCP, here's a hello world text file that I just keep on this computer. So I'll send that to CLAT2 at 192.168.122.1:. I'll just put that in my downloads folder. Of course, it needs my password. And it sent something somewhere. Let's go over to the host and just verify that that's where I would expect it to be. Yeah, there's the hello world.txt. So I'm communicating between the virtual machine and the host. A lot of applications, a lot of virtual machine managers enable this by default anyway. It just gets turned on for you. You don't have to worry about it, or you have a plugin that allows host and virtual machine communication under certain, through certain channels. So this might not be that big of a deal, but this is kind of this is how that's happening, is that the virtual machine's network interface, instead of being some data streamed to your host for processing, it's data streamed to this Ethernet bridge, which then sends that data on through your Ethernet port to whatever destination it's intended to. So that's Bridge Cuddle, really. Obviously, a lot of this has kind of happened outside of, like, really my interaction. Like, the bridge itself was created on its own. The device was added to the bridge on its own. Like, I didn't do that through the command. But as I said, if you just run brcuddle and look at the screen, it tells you how to do everything manually. So you could add a bridge, name it something like my bridge 0, and then you'd have a bridge. That would exist. And then you could add an interface to that bridge, and you could add another interface to that bridge. And now those two interfaces kind of hang out together. They are bridged together through this virtual device. It's really time for coffee, but let's talk about one more command before we go get coffee. BSD finger. So the command is finger. That's what it is, but it is from the BSD packages, I guess. And so it's prefaced with BSD dash finger, but what you type into the terminal is just finger. And this is strangely, for some reason, I remember when I was learning Unix and Linux, I just felt like finger came up a lot more than it had any right to do. Like, I don't know what it is about this command. I feel like a lot of people learn about it really early on, maybe just because it's got kind of a funny name for a command, finger. Like, that's weird. I also think that the output might be somewhat, like, when you're teaching someone about a terminal interface, it is difficult sometimes to kind of communicate to them in a way that they'll understand what they're even expected, or what to expect from this interface. And the command ls, I mean, that's a pretty good way to get consistent output, at least as long as you know that your demo machine has something to list. I mean, otherwise they just see a bunch of dots, and that's not very demonstrative of anything. So finger, I think, is kind of a way to get some reliable output. I mean, it has data in columns, so that could be a great way to introduce tools like cut and awk and things like that. So I get why maybe it comes up more often than it should. All it really does, it's a lot like who or w. I mean, it shows you logged in users, but it has a couple of extra columns there at the end, with specifically their office room number, their office phone number, and their full name, as provided by, of course, them when they created their user account, or when you created their user account. On Slackware, you may use user add, the user add script. And if you do, then you'll recall, I think it's user add, right? I always get add user and user add mixed up. One of those two, the one that's a script. At the end of that, it prompts you for your full name, for your, like, your office room number, your office phone, a couple of other things. And that data gets stored and then later queried by finger should anyone need that information about you. Now, in real life, like in modern Linux usage, I don't think that that's probably commonly very useful. In a big organization, it is possible that that's useful, assuming that the big organization is running a true multi-user system where everyone is actually logging in through some kind of centralized server. And they haven't instead gone to LDAP, or they're using, you know, finger in addition to LDAP, which is quite possible. I have worked at such a place. I've worked at a company where they're, you know, when you signed onto your workstation, you were signing onto a multi-user system. You really were. You could use wall and message to message people. You could use finger and a bunch of other little just custom tools that they wrote to find out exactly where people were sitting in the building or what their phone extension was and so on. And so it actually was, bizarrely, you know, 10 years into my Linux usage, it ended up being like a really, really useful tool. And after I left that company, I haven't touched it ever since. In fact, I don't even know why it's installed right now. I should uninstall it. So that's finger. It gives you information about users on a multi-user system. But if you are, like, I think I would say probably most Linux users, is that most? I don't know. A lot of Linux users. You're on a computer. You've got a laptop running Linux. You've got a desktop running Linux. There's no other people signed into that same machine at the same time. And if they are, they're just over in the other room. And you're probably logged in through a terminal, you know, and they're using the desktop or something like that. So I doubt that most people probably find Finger sort of very pragmatically useful. But it's a famously, I mean, it's because of the name, it is a famous command. So, I mean, there it is. That's Finger. That's what it does. If you didn't fill out your information when you first started when you created your user, then you may not have a bunch of information in there. And you might feel somewhat cheated, but you can add that information. However, I cannot tell you how. It's not because I don't want to, it's just because that is not in this package. This package only contains Finger, the Finger daemon, and the man page for Finger. So I'm not allowed to talk about chfn, which is the command to change Finger. So that's literally chfn. Obviously, I'm being silly. I can do whatever I want. It's my show. So man chfn, that's change your Finger information. You can give your full name, your office room number, your office phone, your home phone, and that's it. You do that and it gets stored with your user profile, and then people can query that. You can also prevent Finger from finding you, or rather from providing information about you, and that is that's back in the man Finger page. It's a /.nofinger. If Finger finds a .nofinger file in your home directory, then for Finger requests originating outside the local host, deny the existence of that user. So there you go, just in case you need that. I think it's time for coffee. Let's go get some. Okay, I'm back and I have coffee, and I know what you think I'm going to say. I'm not going to say it. I'm not drinking Robert Harris coffee. I've graduated on from that. I've gotten some flight coffee called Memphis. I don't know. Are they talking about Tennessee? Or are they talking about Egypt? I'm not sure. I like the name though, so I tried the coffee, and it's good coffee. This is actually really, really good coffee. I mean, no surprise. It's flight coffee. I'm gradually resigning myself to sort of the idea that I'm mostly a flight coffee drinker now. Like that's my coffee. My go-to coffee place. Obviously, I get coffee from other places when I'm. You know, in a city and come across a new coffee roaster that I'd not tried before or whatever, but flight is reliable. It's there. It doesn't take long for them to ship my coffee to me. It's just really good, and it tastes really good. Memphis says that it has subtle undertones of hazelnut and chocolate or something like that. I don't know. I don't taste it. It's just good coffee. Very good stuff. Nice and rich. It says it's a dark roast, a dark roast. And again, I don't really even feel like it's that dark of a roast. So I just think this is really, really good coffee. Memphis. I'm imagining it's talking about Egypt, because I've never been to Egypt. I want to visit, but I've never been. But really, I mean, who doesn't love ancient Egypt, all the mythology around that, sort of the romanticism? So that's what I'm imagining. It's the coffee of the ancient temple of Memphis. Let's talk about Sea Ares or Sea Ares or Cares. I'm not really sure how to say it. If you go to c-ares.org, you'll also not be able to, you'll not know how to pronounce it. They don't tell you at all. It's got a backstory. Sea Ares is a sort of a fork, really, of the Ares project, which both of these is a DNS resolver. They're Ares, or C-Ares is a DNS resolver library. So if you're writing a library or an application and you need it to translate addresses to IP addresses to domain names and domain names to IP addresses, either with IP version 4 or 6, C-A-R-E-S could be for you. The reason it exists, I think, is, well, I mean, actually, I don't think. I mean, they have a why link at the top of their page. And if you click on why, they tell you exactly why it exists. There are six main points, each one with one or more points underneath it. And it kind of boils down to things like synchronous and asynchronous interfaces. It needs to do IPv4 and IPv6. It must support hostname and address lookup, A and pointer or PTR types. So it does all the stuff that we were kind of talking, or it does the reverse of what we were talking about with bind. Now that you've configured essentially a bind server, this maybe makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you give an application a domain name, then you want it to fluidly and invisibly translate it as a user. You want it to translate it to an IP address. Or if you don't know the domain name, or if there is no domain name, you want to be able to give it an IP address and have it function normally. So that's what this is for. But it's for the developer. It's something that a developer would use and in order to give their application the ability to just handle domain names and IP addresses. They don't have to reinvent anything. You don't have to, as the user, think about which one to use. You can just use them interchangeably. You just don't care. It becomes as fluid and I guess invisible as it is with a web browser. All right, next up is CA certificates. CA, I think, is certificate authority, right? So I guess I've never really noticed that about CA certificates. Certificate authority certificates? I don't know, maybe CA doesn't stand for certificate authority. Either way, these are sort of you can think of them as PGP or GPG keys or an SSH key maybe if you want to think of it that way, except for OpenSSL. And the idea behind OpenSSL is that in order to talk, well, encrypted traffic is better than non-encrypted traffic, right? I mean, we've kind of, I think there are very notable exceptions to that sort of law. And yet I also can't really argue with the concept that, well, if you can just have it encrypted, then you may as well have it encrypted. I mean, even though some websites don't really need encryption, like you can go to GNUWorldOrder.info or MixSignals.ml or SlackRemedia.info, you'll never need encryption. It just won't matter to you because nothing on there is interacting with personal data of yours in any way, and everything that it's transmitting is completely public information. So the encrypted traffic between you and that machine, it doesn't really matter. I know that there's some edge case out there where, well, yes, but you could go to SlackerMedia.something else, and there could be malicious software on that server, and you could be tricked into running it somehow, I guess. So the point is that whether it's for trust that you are talking to the same server you were talking to yesterday, or whether it is because you want to establish a connection with a server and then encrypt the traffic between you and that server. In both cases, you each need some kind of identification token, some way of verifying that you've seen each other before. And this is kind of my main sort of problem with SSL, although my problem, there's air quotes around problem, with SSL has diminished a lot over the years, the more the internet has kind of become dominated by big companies that, after a fashion, like, you're on a server, and now you actually can trust that server is the server, because everything's that server, like, everything belongs to this, you know, these five different companies. So, well, more on that in a minute, I guess, but you want to establish some kind of connection with a server. In order for that to happen, you both need something that you can recognize. And the system for a very long time has been that some central authority decides, usually through payment, monetary payment, decides to hand out a key to some organization. So a company pays for the inclusion in the big CA cert package. They get included, they get the lock to their door, and you, when you download the CA certificate package, that's what this is, you get a bunch of keys to a bunch of different locks. And whenever you come to a server with a lock on it on the internet, your browser is programmed to look in your certificate stash and see if you've got the right key. if you've got a matching key to that lock, then you can trust that that server with that lock on it is the server that it claims to be. Or at least it's the server that belonged to the person who paid the bill to have their key distributed by this central authority. That's as far as that trust goes. Now, like I say, 10 years ago, that didn't say much, because at that point, really, like, the internet was kind of a different place. There were a lot of different people running servers on the internet. I mean, there still are, but you could find yourself on lots of different websites back then. These days, I feel like, bizarrely, the internet's kind of gotten a little bit smaller, or maybe not smaller, but maybe a little bit more threadbare. And there's a certain set of companies that just own all of the services online. And so it is actually probably pretty reliable that if you come to a server with a Microsoft branded lock on it, or a Google branded lock on it, or a Facebook branded lock on it, then yeah, that's probably actually their server. And you can actually really trust that the company owns that server. And it's pretty easy to just kind of establish that level of the same level of corporate to person trust as ever. For individuals, I feel like SSL used to be a little bit of a blocker to establishing trust, because you had to have a certain sum of money to buy your way into the central authority. And then one year, EFF came out with the Let's Encrypt campaign. Someone wrote AcmeBot, and suddenly you could get a free SSL certificate that was essentially signed by, well, I guess, Let's Encrypt, technically. They were footing the bill to get there, or not. I don't know how it all works, but they have their keys in the central authority. So your web browser knows about Let's Encrypt. So now when you go to a server with a Let's Encrypt branded lock on it, you have that key. And isn't that convenient? Now you can establish you don't know the trust, but you can establish the encrypted traffic between you and that server. You don't know who runs that server, why they're running the server, what they've got on the server, but your web browser at least can establish an encrypted communication to that server, and it doesn't stop and warn you that it's an unrecognized or a self-signed certificate and that it can't be trusted and that you're at great risk. And in order to proceed onto that website, you have to go to the advanced button and tell it that you accept the risk and that you continue and so on. So SSL has become a little bit more accessible, I think, to a lot of people ever since Let's Encrypt. And I mean, what value the EFF has gifted the digital world with Let's Encrypt. I mean, that was really, I think, kind of a game changer for exactly what it said it was going to do, which is encrypt everything. It is almost, I would say, trivial. And by trivial, I'll qualify that. I mean, if you're setting up your own server, your own web server, then by the time you get to the part of doing the SSL certificate, at that point, that's a trivial task. Like, if you've gotten that far, then setting up using AcmeBot, not even a problem. And a lot of web hosts out there these days, they just gift it for you for free. They just manage that. They have all the scripts already installed on your user account that run and refresh the Let's Encrypt, the AcmeBot script. So it's really, really easy, and it used to not be. And that was a big part of my problem with SSL, was that it was oddly sort of exclusive for such a long time. But now that it's basically the lingua franca of how you're going to talk to servers online, doesn't seem like that big of a deal to me. Let's talk about SIFS-UTILS. SIFS-UTILS is the a utility package for a CIFS file system, which I don't really know what that stands for. I've never really thought about it. All I know is that it's a Samba. It's the file system utilized by SMB, or the open source version of SMB is Samba. So SIFS-UTILS comes with 5 different applications. There's Samba Info or SMB Info. There's Git CIFS ACL to look at the ACL, what does that stand for? Access control list. Set CIFS ACL, so you can set ACL attributes. Samba 2 quota, so if you've got quotas set, you can interface with that. And then CIFS creds, which are the credentials, such as username and password in order, you know, to for a user to access the file system. I've run a Samba server in the past a couple of times. Never used any of these utilities. I'm not saying these utilities aren't useful. They're useful. I'm just saying I've never run into a situation where I needed this level of control. The ACL list I never bothered with, and the credentials I just set up front and then never had to change. So useful utilities, but not something that I have any real world experience with. Next up, contract tools. Contract tools are, that's C-O-N-N, like connection, track, like we're tracking things, tools. And this is basically two commands. It's something like contract itself, and then I think just contract D, which is the daemon. This is sort of an interactive, it's not, but I'm going to say it's an interactive firewall. So the packets that enter and depart from your system, they all get little labels. And the packets are just, you know, they're not special. They're just little bundles of data, right? We call them packets, but it's data. It's a bunch of data being sent out of your computer or being received by your computer over any number of, over your network interface, but through any number of imaginary channels that we call ports. And somehow those packets, they need to be quantified and categorized and so on, so that your computer knows what to do with them at any given point, especially when running a firewall. So a contract is kind of, it's everything except the firewall. It's all that stuff. It's tracking packets. It's figuring out where they're from, where they're going, how what port they got sent from, what port they're going to. And it's a fascinating if what protocol they're using. Is it TCP? Is it UDP? Is it something else? SMTP, I guess. And you can just run a contract, just contract space dash dash list, I think, or maybe it's dash capital L. Yeah, it's dash capital L, like in IP tables. Contract dash capital L. And that gives you a bunch of output that you're going to kind of recognize if you've ever looked at IP table rules. This is going to look really familiar to you. This is the table of packets currently, you know, sort of being tracked by your system. So for instance, here's a TCP connection established from my IP address destined to this IP address. The source port was 600.86. The destination port is 443. So it's going to an SSL port. The source and the destination, the source port, destination port, mark 0, use 1, and so on. And that just, it goes on and on and on and on. You can put it into sort of a monitoring mode, kind of like UDEV ADM or whatever that one is, by using the dash capital E option. So contract dash capital E, that shows you the events. So when you first do that, you'll probably have nothing showing. I mean, you might, it kind of depends on when you catch it. You might catch like your server, or rather your computer pinging your router or your gateway or whatever. But otherwise, for instance, you can see some ICMP traffic by opening up another terminal. So you've got contract dash E running, capital E, running in one terminal. You open up another window and just ping 8.8.8.8, for instance. That's the big Google domain name server. That's obviously pretty easy to remember. You ping that and then go look back over in your contract dash capital E terminal, and you sure enough, you see a new packet, ICMP, source, your IP address, destination 8.8.8.8. Does it tell us the source port? No, because it's ICMP, I guess. Yeah. Okay. So, there's a ping from my a UDP packet from my gateway server, actually, that just happened to come in. So yeah, I mean, if you leave it in dash capital E long enough, you do start to see activity. And that's kind of fascinating. And the output of contract without any further options gives you a bunch of the common options. It gives you that in a list. And you can see that you can filter the output by just the source or just the destination or just the port or the protocol, that sort of thing. Feels a little bit like Wireshark or IP tables. Kind of the same kind of, well, I mean, you're looking at packets. So you've got a bunch of filter options. What's really fun is that you can also label your own, you can add your own labels to things. So if you do that, then you can start tracking things, just your own custom way of tracking things. That's Contrac. Next up is CRDA. That's the Central Regulatory Domain Agent. It makes sure that your Linux computer can comply with frequency usage regulations for your wireless card and things like that. The package itself says that you probably aren't going to use this unless you're debugging stuff, and I could see that they're not tools that normally you're going to need. All of this is just part of the way your wireless subsystem works. There are some interesting little things you can look at. I mean, regdbdump dumps the database of the regulations. Like it tells you what they are. So if you do regdbdump and then the regulatory.bin file is in user lib crda regulatory.bin, do that, and you literally you just get to see the contents of this thing. So it gives you the country code for each entry, and then it shows you the frequencies that are permitted. I guess, I mean, there are a bunch of numbers that mean nothing to me, but that's what I'm assuming these are. That would make sense. Like, it looks to me like they're bandwidths, but I guess I could be wrong. And then there is the CRDA command itself, and it allows you to set the country code that your environment is listed in. I just ran it, and it says that the country environment variable has not been set, which kind of surprised me. But I mean, I'm assuming some kind of default is loaded, but you can set it with CRDA, and that loads the regulations for that country into your kernel. What kind of ramification that might have in your locality, I do not know. The next command is curl, and I mean, I can't rush through that. So let's just save that for probably half of an episode all of its own. I mean, curl is huge. We've talked about it before. Oh, this is the library version of curl, isn't it? This is just the library, I think. Yeah, that would make sense. Var log packages, curl. No, I think this is, yeah, no, this is the actual thing. This is curl. Yeah, let's just talk about that next week. Everybody loves curl. That'll be a great half episode at least. No, you know what? Better yet, let's not talk about curl next episode. Next episode, I have something else I want to talk about, and then we'll talk about curl the next episode, which means that you, dear listener, have a good week and a couple of days to send me by email or Mastodon, whatever you want. You can either send it to klaatu@slackermedia.info or on Mastodon or Matrix, whatever you choose. Send me the way that you use curl, like some curl commands that you really love, or how you know what you use curl to do, or whatever. Just talk to me about curl, and that way I can include that in the curl episode, because I know someone out there has a really cool curl use case or a cool command. And, or, you know, a series of options that they use with curl. So show me that, and we'll cover it in not the next episode, but the next episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.fm.
XYZ. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on GNUWorldOrder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
I wonder if you'd be kind enough to help me out a little. I'm a stranger here.